Next cases are 04-1171 and 04-1267, State of Ohio versus Preston Mathis and Dwayne Fair. Mr. Regas.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Alan Regas. I'm Assistant Prosecuting Attorney in the Office of William Mason, Cuyahoga County Prosecutor. I'd ask the court to allow me to have 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay, watch your time.
Thank you. Before this court are two cases. These appeals deal with sentencing issues. And both, in both these cases, in both the Fair case and in the Mathis case, both decisions have gone to disposition at the appellate level of vacating the sentences. However, in both decisions, the appellate court explicitly found that no findings supporting the consecutive sentences had been made by the sentencing court. And this court accepted jurisdiction solely for the purpose to determine the scope and the authority of the appellate court in reviewing these sentences and sentencing decisions, and the scope and authority of remand upon what would occur after the Court of Appeals has determined no findings have been made. Under
counsel, if we were to accept that they should only remand for making the findings rather than a resentencing, what do we do with the circumstance where the court really doesn't have any findings to make? They didn't make the findings because they weren't there, and if you send it back, they still aren't there. How do we fit that issue, that scenario, into the structure?
In that scenario, if the trial court, when it goes back and says, in imposing, for example, consecutive sentences, and making the findings, and inherently make the reasons and stating those reasons that go with that, in that case, then the trial court would say, I cannot make the findings. These findings are not supported by the record. And then it would go back to the appellate court in order to be vacated.
You think you have any trial court that really would say that?
I mean, they
gave the sentence in the first place, obviously believing something merited the sentence.
Exactly. However, the situation could arise where the trial court misinterpreted a fact or did not apply something properly under the findings. Because the findings under Ohio's the sentencing, they're an exercise in analysis. There's at least 15 findings that are possible to be made in sentencing for felonies. And a lot of those findings have similar semantics, similar words, and underlying similar concepts. In those cases, perhaps the court realizes that a factor that it had determined imposing a more than the minimum sentence in reaching a maximum sentence than a consecutive sentence was an error. And in that case, then the court would have to, as I believe the opinion here, the dissenting judge actually acknowledged an error. And I would hope that the bench in Ohio has the integrity to do so and acknowledge
that. In fact, I want to take what you were about to say. I had the same question, but I want to assume that the trial judge cannot give reasons or doesn't give adequate reasons. Then it goes back to the Court of Appeals, and under the statute, the problem is under 295308, doesn't tell us what happens, does it? It says that to remand the case to the sentencing court and instruct the sentencing court to state on the record the requested findings. Well, the trial court can't do that. Then what happens?
Well, then the trial court needs to state the findings can't be made
situation. Court of Appeals has to review what happens to the sentence?
That's the
underlying question here. And then what happens to the sentence if the trial court made the sentence, Court of Appeals says you didn't do it right, sends it back, trial court says either expressly says it or doesn't do it, what happens to the sentence? Is there no sentence?
Then the sentence, at that point, I would say no, that under the procedure that has been set forth, Your Honor, under that procedure, it would have to go back to the Court of Appeals in order to have that sentence vacated as being unsupported and contrary to law, because the findings could not be made. Because the trial court would not, the trial court under G1, 2953-08-G1, it's a remand not to correct the record, but to complete the record. Because the judge obviously had reasons for imposing the sentence that was imposed. It was imposed.
Well, we hope so. We hope so.
Well, we do hope so.
Not always obvious. We hope so. We assume. But and what if not? We have to deal with what happens under the statute if the trial court can't do that. For some reason, the trial court didn't do it the first time. It may have been oversight. But it also may have been because the trial court just wasn't sure about it. So trial court does what it did. So you say that the Court of Appeals would vacate the sentence?
And in that point, then, at that point, a full analysis of the findings, whether they can be made or not, and the reasons and the adequacy of those reasons and legality of the reasons supporting the findings that were made or were not made, then under 2953-08-G2, then the disposition of modifying, altering, enlarging the sentence.
Because G2 gives the Court of Appeals the authority to modify, reduce, otherwise increase, or whatever. That's your argument.
Exactly. And that's the procedure. Because when this statute was amended in 2000, it didn't have a specific provision to make the record complete. And what was happening was, and it's still happening as evidenced by the FAIR will end up having a third appeal in this case.
Would a possible solution be for the trial court to remand under G1 to make the required findings, but to add a sort of a phrase to the remand, but if the trial court cannot make the required findings, then to resentence the defendant pursuant to statute?
I don't think that, because the statute is specific and the right to appeal these sentences that we're talking about under G1, the sentences that overcome sentencing presumptions and the consecutive sentences and the judicial release for first and second degree felons. In that case, in those cases, I don't think the Court of Appeals and the trial court have the authority to do that. I think this procedure is a limited remand back to the trial court to complete the record so that review can then be done.
Isn't the problem generally that the trial court has forgotten to do something that was technical? I mean, we generally have a sentence that is within the range, so it's not contrary to law because it's exceeded the maximum. It hasn't totally been unsupported, but the problem may be certain findings were not stated on the record, certain reasons may not have been given, and since the Comer case says you must do all of this at the time of sentencing, it's very easy, as you said, with 15 separate sections of the sentencing law to look at, it's very easy for the court to overlook one of these things. So that under G1, if the Court of Appeals returns it to the trial court may simply remedy the situation by going to the statute that was overlooked and then reciting for the record, on the record, what was missing. And so we're talking about the ability to correct something that's easily corrected, are we not?
And yes, we are. It's very simple. It's not a full resentencing hearing. It would be a remand to complete the record for the trial court to explain what the sentencing decision was, as was required at the time of the sentencing. Simply by vacating the sentencing, we're ending up with multiple appeals. We're ending up with decisions by an appellate court that turn out to be merely advisory because they're not dealing with the same and a complete record. And I would posit that in the FAIR case, that is what is occurring here. The appellate decision here states that some of the reasons that the trial court justified imposing sentence or stated as reasons were insufficient. However, the record's incomplete. The findings were never made. So we don't know which of those reasons correlated to which finding in the consecutive sentencing.
Well, Mr. Riggs, if that's the case, what do you want us to do with Fair? You've already suggested, I think, that there's going to be a third appeal. What is your recommendation for the rule of law you want us to write in the Fair case?
In the Fair case, I would ask that this court vacate the 8th District or reverse the 8th District opinion as to the sentencing issues and remand it to the trial court for the trial court to complete the record, not to conduct a sentencing de novo or to conduct a new hearing, but to explain under the analytic framework that's set forth in the statute.
So in Fair, you really want to have a resentencing, and what is it that you're seeking in Mathis?
We're seeking the exact same resolution. In this case, there were no findings made as to the consecutive sentence. And although the dissenting judge in Mathis did determine that the findings were made, and that goes to the confusion that's inherent, and especially in these maximum consecutive sentences, where the maximum and more than the minimum findings mimic the findings in 2914E4, where the finding that needs to be made is not disproportionate to the seriousness of the offense and the danger that the offender poses to the public. That's so similar and potentially redundant to the finding under E4C that the criminal history demonstrates consecutive sentences are necessary to protect the public. Those are so similar that a trial court often, and we see it in these maximum consecutive sentences, and here we have two of them, that finding that supports under E4C, the history and the danger, that's made under the maximum in the worst form of the offense and the person that and the offender poses the greatest likelihood of recidivism. Those same reasons are given in imposing the maximum sentence, and the trial court, in error, does not, under Comer, restate that, does not repeat itself. And that, I think, is what occurred in the Mathis case.
Counsel, does the trial or the appellate court have the discretion to say, this is a G1, you didn't make the requisite findings, and a limited remand, or go to G2 and say, the findings you've made don't support your sentence, so we're going to exercise our ability to vacate, modify, remand for resentencing, whatever. Does the court have that discretion to make that distinction?
No. Under G1, it's a mandatory remand. If it determines that the findings were not made, the statute requires that
the findings were made, but the court says you didn't make sufficient findings to support your judgment. I mean, there's a fine line, I understand, but at some point a court may have made the finding it's going to make, which is goes back to the first question that the chief and I asked. The court may say you've made findings, but they don't support your judgment, so we're going to exercise our right under G2 and modify it.
And then that would be proper, because G2 requires a review of the entire record. It specifically states that those findings need to be made. And I would ask that this court apply the procedure that's been put in place in 08 G1 and 2 and require these cases to be remanded to the sentencing court for a complete record and a statement of the findings. And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Regas. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Your Honors, Mr. Fair comes before the court today and asks the court to affirm the decision of the 8th District. Your Honors, in looking at this, the first question that Mr. Fair respectfully suggests to the court is that he should not be here. The state's proposition of law, even if accepted by this court, will still result in Dwayne Fair receiving a new sentencing hearing. And the reason for that is severalfold. First, Your Honors, 2953-08-G1 does not address the failure to make findings with respect to the imposition of maximum sentences. That is conspicuously absent from 2953-08-G1. This court is well familiar with the canons of statutory construction that state that when the General Assembly includes certain provisions within a statute, the inclusion of those is the exclusion of all others. And so, without reiterating the Latin, which I'll stumble over, the fact of the matter is that in this case, for the old adage of inclusio unius est exclusio alterius, this court cannot...
Could you translate that?
The inclusion of one is the exclusion of all others, Your Honor. Your Honor's legislative experience, I'm sure, has caused him to hear that many a time. Your Honors, at the end of the day, therefore, Mr. Fair still comes back because of the maximum sentences. So even if this court were to accept the state's proposition of law, this case could be dismissed even as improvidently granted. Secondly, 2953OHE1 talks about findings. It does not talk about reasons. And with respect to Mr. Fair, and for that matter, to our companion case today, the problem in this case was not simply a failure to make findings with respect to consecutive sentences, but also to furnish reasons for those findings. And that was discussed in the Fair case at paragraph 44. It was discussed in the companion case at paragraph 53, I believe, that there was no mention of a reason that would have been necessary for a finding. So if we take the state's argument and say, well, 2953OHE1 requires remand for the trial court to make required findings. Notice, by the way, 2953OHE1, if I can take a detour for a second, does not say for the missing finding. It says for required findings, which means all of them. But if we take the state's argument that all we're doing here is some type of ministerial task where we send it back to the trial court and we say, now make the findings, several problems arise. First, in most cases, a failure to make a finding is going to be accompanied by a reason for that finding. So this becomes unworkable. Secondly, to have the trial court, if we took the words of G1 literally, it doesn't even say make the findings if you can. It simply says make the findings, you're required. So if the state wants a literal interpretation of G1, they run into constitutional problems because they would be causing the trial court to have to make a finding whether it believes it or not. That cannot be the law.
Don't we assume that the legislature assumes that the trial judge is doing it correctly and that there are findings, I mean, there are reasons.
Precisely, Your Honor. And because we understand that the legislature knows how this process works, we go to the third aspect of that, which is the fact that the legislature knows the difference between findings and reasons. They've made that very clear in 2929-19. State versus Edmondson put that to rest a long time ago. And Your Honors, the legislature would not say to a trial court, go back and simply make a finding without going through the analysis of 2929-11 and 2929-12 and giving reasons for your findings, because at the end of the day, this is a process. It's a holistic process, if you will, by which sentences are arrived, not by coming to a bottom line and working backwards, but by looking at the 2929-11 goals, by looking at the 2929-12 factors, both aggravating and mitigating. Yes, Your Honor.
I asked the same question I asked your opposing counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the appellate court have the discretion to look at a case and say, the judge didn't make the required findings, they skip that technical step or whatever and send it back under G1, or look at it and say, these findings aren't sufficient and the reasons aren't there, so the argument you're making, and do a G2 type of remand or modification?
And that comes to the, perhaps, where I should have gotten to much earlier, which is, this is where the court has to see, how can we cause G1 and G2 to be compatible, as the court must do if it's possible. And the explanation would be as follows. With respect to those particular situations enumerated in G1, Your Honor, which are the situations under 29-29-13B, 13D, 29-29-14E4, and 29-29-20H. Those limited situations, which, by the way, are prison for an F4 or an F5, community control for an F1 or an F2, consecutive sentences, or judicial release on an F1 or F2. In those four situations, G1 is specific and therefore limits the court's G2, the appellate court's G2 discretion. G2 says appellate courts have basically three choices: affirm, modify, either up, down, or otherwise, or vacate and reverse. And it's vacate and reverse that's specific in G2. It doesn't say remand for a limited hearing. It says vacate and reverse, which means the first sentence is now a nullity. So those are the three options under G2.
Excuse
what G1
me. Yes, does it not say vacate and remand the sentence to the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I used the term reverse. I should say vacate and remand for resentencing.
For resentencing.
But the operative word there, Your Honor, is vacate, in that what it is saying is that the first sentence never was.
But is it vacate the entire sentence or just vacate the portion that was defective? What does vacate refer to?
Vacate is referring to sentence, Your Honor, and so therefore it is to vacate the entire sentence.
It doesn't say vacate the entire sentence, though, does it?
If Your Honor would bear with me for just one moment.
It says the sentence.
The sentence, Your Honor. It says the sentence earlier in the, and I didn't want to state it wrong. It says that the appellate court may increase, reduce, or otherwise modify a sentence that is appealed under this section, or may vacate the sentence and remand the matter to the sentencing court. There is but one sentence under Ohio law. My client receives one sentence. He may receive multiple terms of imprisonment within that sentence, but the term sentence refers to the entire package. And so what G1 does is to provide a limitation. I hope this is responsive to Your Honor's question. G1 provides a limitation and says to the Court of Appeals, in those limited situations enumerated in G1, you do not have the discretion to modify. In those situations, you must remand and allow the trial court to take the first crack at it. In other situations, you have the discretion still to vacate, or not, to vacate, but also the discretion to modify, increase or reduce. And so therefore, those two statutes become compatible. They become susceptible to an interpretation that gives value to both in pari materia, so that I can complete the Latin for the day.
I was hoping you'd have some Latin for us on that point. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. And so, Your Honors, at the end of the day, this is not a difficult decision, I would submit to the court respectfully, in that it is a decision that can be rendered by typical canons of statutory construction. The last canon of statutory construction I would submit to the court to consider is the notion that the General Assembly also does not intend unreasonable results.
Would it not be unreasonable, though, to look at it this way? We're talking about potentially sending it back to the trial court first under G1, and let's say that it was they may have corrected under G1 one of the sections that was a problem. And then under G2, the Court of Appeals looks at it again, may find another technicality that's a problem. Only under G2, there must be an entire resentencing. Then it goes back to the trial court from the very beginning. With all those problems, if a technicality is missed, then we continue on. Where does the finality end here?
The finality comes when the court vacates a sentence. We start over and we begin again. 'Twas never And so therefore, we start over. And we start with the trial court beginning with a blank slate. The problem, the unworkable aspect, becomes the state's suggestion that this case is going to come up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals is going to call time out and say, oops, we're missing findings. Regardless of whether there's reasons here or not, regardless of whether there's findings with respect to maximum sentences or whatever or not, send it right back to the trial court, have them conduct a hearing at which the trial court can only say, I find X. Can't give you any reasons, can't consider any arguments, can't do anything else because G1 only tells me I can make findings. Then it goes back up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals says, okay, now we have a complete record, and we can go ahead and do this. Respectfully, Your Honors, the General Assembly did not intend for courts of appeals to be held in abeyance while this type of exercise took place, particularly when the General Assembly has always looked upon sentencing and findings and reasons, while distinct, as necessarily being related. And as this court has said in Comer, aligned. So at the end of the day, the General Assembly did not intend to make SB 2 any more difficult. All it intended to do was to limit the courts of appeals' discretion in these limited areas and say that in those limited areas, we're going to allow the trial court to make whatever sentence it chooses to make in a new sentencing hearing, and we will not allow the Court of Appeals to impose its judgment. In that, I have now cost my co-counsel 37 seconds. Unless Your Honors have any further questions, I thank the court for its indulgence and pray for the relief requested.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Ryan, you have a little less than 3 minutes, about 2.5 minutes, actually.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court. My name is Thomas Ryan. I represent the defendant appellee, Preston Mathis. I submit to this honorable court, and I'll certainly incorporate all of Mr. Martin's arguments as well on behalf of Mr. Mathis, but I submit to this honorable court that what is required here is a de novo hearing upon a, what I would call, and for lack of a better term, a resentencing. Certainly, G2 indicates that appellate court has two options, may increase, reduce or otherwise modify a sentence, or in response to Justice O'Donnell's inquiry prior to me getting up here, the other option is may vacate the sentence and remand the matter to sentencing court for resentencing. I submit to this honorable court that a resentencing includes a de novo review. You have to start from the beginning. Again, the statute is very clear under G1 and G2. At no time is ever the term factors used in either of those code sections. It specifically uses legislature specifically intended, and in the code itself says findings. I submit to this court that the whole matter then upon some sort of obvious error in the original sentence, that a resentencing then in its entirety has to be done for a number of reasons. Obviously, then there was some error in the onset. I think this honorable court has to send a message to trial courts to be very particular in terms of going through. And I've been involved in a lot of cases where the reasoning by trial courts are so convoluted and there's intertwined, especially in the Mathis case, there's findings that overlapped having to do with sexual predator.
Haven't we spoken to that already in our cases in which we said the trial courts have to follow the statute?
It's still, Your Honor, with all due respect, it's still not being done. Still, courts do not go through the checklist as required when saying, well, I'm going to defer. First of all, very few trial courts say, I'm first going to consider the minimum. Second of all, to even get to the maximum sentence and or a consecutive sentence, court does not go through and follow 29-29-13 or 29-29-14. And that's why we have this plethora of cases on the appellate level and ultimately in front of this court. I think what ultimately the message has to be sent to the lower courts that if you don't follow the law as per the legislature and per this honorable court, that we're going to go back and we're going to go round and round and round talking about finality. We're going to go round and round circles until ultimately the trial courts say, okay, I'm going to first consider the minimum. The minimum is not appropriate for this is the reason. I'm going to consider the maximum. Here's why. Here are the specific findings.
So it's your view then that in a hypothetical case with multiple convictions, and multiple sentences imposed by a trial court where a particular finding on the imposition of a consecutive sentence with maybe the fifth count consecutive with the eighth count, where the court fails to make one finding, an appellate court would be required to vacate the entire sentence, remand the entire proceeding for a de novo proceeding with defense counsel and the prosecuting attorney, and the whole procedure starts all over again, not just for making the particular finding with respect to consecutive, but with respect to the entire sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. It's my position that the whole thing has to be done over again to make sure that it's overall done right that time. And again, statute says...
I understand. I just want to clarify your position. Thank you.
It says remand for resentencing. It doesn't say just for that one specific finding or factor. I think then the whole thing has to be reviewed. Certainly any sentencing that's done is not done specifically as to one finding, factor, reasoning. It's done in a whole context of things. Obviously, you may hear from victims. You may hear from, obviously, defense counsel, defendant, anybody the defendant wishes to bring forward. Therefore, it's got to be done overall in the whole context and the whole scheme.
Okay.
I submit to this honorable court that, as to Mr. Mathis, then this case should be remanded to the trial court for a de novo resentencing as to those matters.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rodriguez, you saved 2 minutes.
Thank you. I think it becomes apparent by Appley's arguments in this case that they're putting the cart before the horse. The appellate court cannot get to the disposition in G2 in these cases until the findings are made. And a limited remand to the trial court would consist of a hearing, and as Kilmer stated, on the record, meaning the defendant is present, but it would preclude, it contemplates that the sentence will be completed, that the duty of the judge to make the findings and state those reasons would be completed at that time, and then a meaningful appellant, a review of sufficiency or adequacy of the reason supporting the sentence, whether it was a legal sentence that was imposed at that time, then
counsel,
that can
how,
be made.
How would the judge do that at that particular time? Just taking a segment of the original sentence, reconsidering it, what would you envision happening on the trial court at that point?
I would envision, as happened in the Marks and Gary cases that are cited in my brief, that the judge would simply say, I imposed this sentence, and this sentence was imposed for these reasons and upon the basis of these findings.
And where would the judge get the information to supplement the faulty finding made previous?
Well, I think that mischaracterizes the fact that the court imposed a sentence and had reasons, and the court needs to state those reasons, and that goes back to the very first question that arose in this argument.
So you're saying the judge then would just take a look at the requisite finding, plug it in where it was deficient to begin with, and issue a new journal entry, and that's it?
No, I'm not. That's not what's contemplated. What's contemplated by the findings, and the findings, because they are, in these cases, require reasons to be given as well by statute, these findings go to an explanation and a justification of the sentence so that it can be reviewed for the principles.
And does the judge do that in a vacuum, or do we have the defendant back in court? Do we have defense counsel, prosecution, any other before the bench in an actual hearing?
I would say that it needs to be done in the presence of the defendant. However, it does not need to go to the extent of receiving new information and opening up to new senses, because that process cannot be, you can't get to that point, Your Honor, until those findings are made and until there's a complete explanation and justification for the sentence that was imposed. The reviewing court is simply left to guess as to which reasons that and which facts in the record apply to which findings, if that's the case. And the statute cannot be read to require only findings. Findings are inherently require reasons in these situations. So the court would need to bring the defendant back pursuant to State versus Comer, state the findings, explain the sentence, not change the sentence, not modify the sentence, because that is not in the contemplation of this procedure.
The defendant would be before the court, obviously, and the court would make the missing finding or findings, and then say this results in the same sentence I've previously imposed, and here it is all over again?
Now, that is one way to characterize what would happen, but I think that this court needs to note that the findings and reasons justify the sentence that was imposed, and the court had those in mind, and the court needs to state those on the record as required by the statute. So I don't think that it's simply rehashing the magic words of the statute. It's actually going back and looking at the record of the sentencing hearing, the trial, the pre-sentence investigation report, and for the judge to simply state, I impose a sentence for this reason, this reason, this reason, and make that finding based upon those reasons. And that is what, it's a meaningful remand in explanation of the court's sentencing decision. And for those reasons, I would ask that this court remand these cases for the simple procedure that we've discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.